Haunted Night, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.
W.J. Pierce for creating and performing our music. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne. Thank you for joining us. Before introducing tonight's guest, I'm going to turn it over to my partner in crime, Tamara Thorne, who's going to tell you a little something about our upcoming novel in the Ravencrest Saga.
Yeah, we're working hard. And this is what it's about. In a remote part of California, just above the coastal town of Devilswood, Ravencrest Manor, imported stone by stone from England more than two centuries ago, looms tall and terrifying, gathering its dark and unnatural powers and drawing those it wants as its own. Ravencrest is back in business. Alistair and I are currently working on the third book in the series titled The Ravencrest Saga, Exorcism. As always, the Ravencrest Saga first appears in serial form, and you can look for the first installment later this spring. Alistair.
All right. And if you need to brush up on the specter scandals and sinister goings-on at Ravencrest, you can get the first two books, The Ghosts of Ravencrest and The Witches of Ravencrest, in paperback or ebook at Amazon. The Ravencrest Saga is a gothic horror tale about a governess named Belinda Moreland who comes to work at the macabre Ravencrest Manor. It's got witches, ghosts, mystery, history, and lots of family secrets. And if you're listening live, the second book in the saga, The Witches of Ravencrest, will be on sale for 99 cents in ebook April 2nd through the 9th. Again, you're listening to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live, and we are thrilled to introduce tonight's guest. This is a woman who single-handedly kicked off the true crime segment of our show. I was watching Murderous Affairs on Netflix a few months back, and I saw her, and I just really liked the way she spoke. I liked her demeanor, and I thought to myself, you know what our show needs is true crime. So... Mm-hmm. This is the first woman I began to stalk, and I caught her. Catherine Pellinaro is the author of the New York Times bestseller Kitty Genovese, A True Account of a Public Murder and Its Private Consequences, a nonfiction book about the notorious 1964 murder case. Kitty Genovese twice made the New York Times bestsellers list, reaching number 10 in Crime and Punishment and number 1 on Amazon in biography and memoir. As a true crime author and commentator, Catherine appears on national TV news broadcasts and crime shows, including episodes of the Emmy-winning series A Crime to Remember, It Takes a Killer, Fox Files, and Murderous Affairs. She is a contributing writer for Investigation Discovery's Crime Feed. Her latest book, Absolute Madness, A True Story of a Serial Killer, Race, and a City Divided, is a nonfiction account of Joseph Christopher, a white serial killer who targeted black men in a crime spree across New York State. Praised by noted FBI profiler John Douglas as a gripping account of a complex and controversial case, Absolute Madness was published in November 2017 to critical acclaim. So, that being said, we are thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome aboard, Catherine.
Yes, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. And I just want to say it is an honor and a privilege to be stalked by you, Alistair. I mean, truly.
Okay, good.
I mean,
good.
Because
it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Yeah. He stalked me, and now we write books together. So be careful.
See? It pays. It pays.
Yeah. It does.
But no, really.
It does.
But no, really, in all seriousness, and I know we were talking about this a little bit, before the show. But I think what kind of stood out to me was, a lot of these shows you watch, them, the commentators are very grave. And you know, you were kind of a breath of fresh air. You I don't know, I just liked the way
that you
handled it. I thought that you were great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I just try to take I'm really just myself on camera. I guess that's the best way to put it. I mean, I never started out. I was never an actor. I was never a professional broadcaster. It was after Kitty Genovese came out that I was asked to do some television programming, and the first one was Fox Files, actually. So it was a completely new experience for me, and I just sat there and talked, and just like I would if I was sitting across the table from you, and, you know, it seems to work. So, yeah.
It does. It really does. Mm-hmm. It really does. I think that's what kind of drew me in. But yeah, it's so. This has been a really interesting journey. It sounds like you did not start as a true crime writer. Where did you start?
No, I actually started as a playwright, and I will say I was one of those people who knew from the time I was about 5 years old that I wanted to be a writer, or that I was a writer. And I was immediately drawn to the theater. I remember my parents went to this neighbor had a yard sale, and they had a complete edition of William Shakespeare, really beautiful volume. And they bought it, and I started reading it. And I think I was about 8 years old. And there was just something about theater that drew me in, and I decided I wanted to be a playwright. So I started writing plays as a kid, and then actually my first professional successes were as a playwright. I started in my hometown of Buffalo, New York. I started working at a couple of theaters around there. And then I had my New York City debut with a short play called Family Names, which it was a two-person comedy. And at the time, it was only a 10-minute play, and that's really before the whole 10-minute play thing had taken off. And it did very well, and they remounted it as part of the Off-Broadway Short Play Festival, and it won. And it was published by Samuel French, and that kind of, you know, launched me.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah, and after that, I was writing almost strictly plays, the occasional teleplayers or screenplay, but pretty much for the live theater, and mostly comedies, and I was, you know, very happy and content. I became a playwright member of the Actors Studio in, I think it was 2008. So the whole true crime thing, yeah, I really just kind of fell into it. It was never anything that was planned. It was just one of those things, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you mentioned to us before the show that your father was a police officer. Do you think
he
that
was.
Had anything to do with it?
I think it did. My father was he was a police officer in Buffalo, New York for 34 years. And so I grew up, obviously, with him, and I adored my dad. I mean, he was, you know, just my idol, is to this day. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2005. But I grew up around police officers and law enforcement. And but again, it was never on my radar to write about crimes or anything. And in fact, my most recent book, Absolute Madness, is about serial killer Joseph Christopher, who I was kind of drawn to the story because this happened in my hometown in the early 1980s. Now, if my father never discussed the case with me. I was just a kid at the time. But when I did start doing research for that book, I ended up speaking to a lot of his colleagues and, you know, guys who had worked with him and, you know, very interesting. So, I think it really, but it definitely helped me when I started writing true crime because I'm very at ease.
Yeah.
You know, with people in law enforcement. And, I mean, so that just really helps tremendously.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. So, okay, so Absolute Madness is the book, and it's about a serial killer named Joseph Christopher. I have never even heard of this guy. Can you tell us who he is, what he did?
Yeah, absolutely. Joseph Christopher was born in 1955 in Buffalo, and he was in the fall of 1980. All of a sudden, there was a series of killings of black men, and in fact, there were four that were gunned down in public streets within a 36-hour period. And the police were able to quickly match the bullet casings, the casings to the same gun. So as incredible as it seems, they realized that this was the work of one person, or at least one of people using the same firearms, because these shootings were definitely related. The victims were not related. And this happened at a particularly bad time. Not that there's ever a good time for serial killings, but in the fall of 1980, the country was in real economic turmoil. Things were quite bad, and especially in places like Buffalo, New York, part of the Rust Belt and the industry had gone and, had enough problems. So this was, the last thing they needed. And particularly, it seemed like the only thing the witnesses could say was that, it was a white guy. Otherwise the descriptions were all over the place. But so now they had a white man who was gunning down black men for no apparent reason. And this happened just 3 years after the Son of Sam case in New York City, which, if you remember David Berkowitz, he would just shoot people and run away. And this was the same thing. Joseph Christopher would just go up, shoot someone, and then take off. So, naturally this caused a lot of terror and, it was a media sensation. And so, very scary. Now, Joseph Christopher, he was 25 years old at the time. The police launched a massive investigation and a big task force was formed. But he was never on the radar because this is a guy who had no criminal record. He just was not on their radar at all, wasn't involved with any hate groups, anything like that. It wasn't until, there were more attacks and killings in December. They stopped for a while and then there were six black men attacked in a single day in New York City, and then a couple days later, more black men killed, this time with a knife, in Buffalo and Rochester. So, really, it really was a sensation in the worst possible way. So it wasn't until April of 1981 that the Buffalo Police Department gets a call from Fort Benning, Georgia, from the Army, from the CID, which is the Central Investigation Division in the Army. And they said, we have a private here from Buffalo, New York, named Joseph Christopher, and he's in our psychiatric hospital, and he keeps talking about how he killed some people in Buffalo and New York City. So, the police take an interest. At this point, they're so desperate, for any sort of a lead, because at this point in the game, they had literally gone over 2,000 leads. Pursued 2,000 leads and, hundreds and hundreds of suspects.
Wow.
So they go down to interview him. Now, Christopher is in the psychiatric ward, so they can't really, they don't really get anything from him, and he won't speak to them. He doesn't believe that they're really police officers. But what they do is they get a search warrant for his home, and they're able to find some casings which they believe match the ones found at the crime scene. And so that's how he was detected. It was actually his own, his own words. And there was nothing simple about it because Christopher was mentally ill, and eventually, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. So they didn't know if his confessions were believable, and there was a lot of controversy. But that's the
right. So did he ever give any reason as to any particular reason why he was doing it? Obviously, they were hate crimes, but was there what was he really choosing his victim for?
Actually, they weren't hate crimes. Because, they weren't. Because what was very interesting was when Christopher first surfaced as a suspect, of course the police look into his background, and he had a number of close black friends, black men who said, you're looking at the wrong guy. No. Joe comes over to my house for dinner. I go to his house for dinner. We're really good pals. Wrong guy. And this is what they heard across the board. And they went to his former employers, and did you ever hear him make a racist remark? No, never. He's the kind of guy who, he helped me move into my apartment. This is the kind of thing they're hearing. But what happened, the crimes were motivated by mental illness. Profound mental illness. He had paranoid schizophrenia, and he was gripped by delusions because, as a couple years go by, he's declared unfit for trial and fit for trial. Once he was medicated for a while and stabilized, he was interviewed by a psychiatrist, and they asked him, well, you know, why did you do this? And he said, well, I was told to. He was hearing voices, so to speak. He says, I thought they were going to come and get me. I said, well, who was going to come and get you? He said, I never knew. He says, I would be walking down the street, and they would tell me, you know. So it was that kind of thing. And I know that there is, there are people who like to discount that, that mental illness. And
right.
I fully realize that it has been used frivolously, shall we say.
Sure.
Like with
yeah.
the, you know, and I completely get that. And it's still a very gray area because you get psychiatrists disagreeing on a diagnosis. But that said, and, you know, from the intense research I did on this book, there is no doubt in my mind that Christopher's crimes were motivated by mental illness because nothing else fit. And I I try to be very thorough in my work. I mean, I talked to his elementary school teachers, guys who were in Boy Scouts with him, you know, just about everyone, his old girlfriend, just about everyone I could find, and his family. And there was just nothing in his history that implied any sort of, like, racist feeling. So this was, unfortunately, sadly, someone who just, you know, was gripped by delusions. And I also found out during the research of the book, he didn't just attack black men. There was a woman. Yeah, in between these.
That's interesting. So how do you go about, you know, you said you talked to his elementary school teacher and all these people. How do you even begin to research a book like this?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, the internet helps tremendously. But what I do, and honestly, I don't know how people wrote nonfiction before the internet. I mean, I can't even imagine, because it really does make things easier. What I do is I try to start with law enforcement, because that's generally like the easiest, the best starting point. You know, looking at court records, talking to detectives or whomever was involved. And then I, you know, going through court records, I'll get names, and also in old newspaper articles, I'll get names of people, and then I Google them, you know, try to find the people, start writing letters. You know, this is who I am. I'm writing this book. I would like to speak to you. It's a long process, and it can be tedious in a way, but at the same time, there's tremendous payoff in it.
Do you enjoy research? Is it something that you, I mean, obviously it's a major part of your job, so you must, you know, not hate it too badly, but is that the best part, or is it the writing, or is it the, look, here's my book? What is really rewarding to you?
Oh, well, I love the research. And again, I fell into this. So I didn't realize that how much I loved it until I was working on Kitty Genovese. The most rewarding part to me is, right after Kitty Genovese came out, I like to try to unearth, you know, I don't want to just regurgitate a story that everyone already knows. You know, so even with the Kitty Genovese story where it was, you know, familiar to a certain extent, I wanted to go and talk to the people who knew her, you know, the things that had never come out before. So when I was, right after the book came out, I was had a speaking engagement at Fordham University, and some of Kitty Genovese's brother, a couple of her brothers and some of her nieces and nephews came. And her brother, Bill, introduced himself, you know, ahead of time. But afterwards, after I talked, and again, I talked off the cuff like I usually do, her family came up and said, thank you for what you said and for what you wrote in the book. Because these are nieces and nephews who had never met her before. And it was sort of, it was really much, very much the same thing with Absolute Madness. I mean, there were people who, I interviewed a couple of Christopher's surviving victims. Then I interviewed some family members, some close friends. And, you know, these are people who have not really been able to talk about this to anyone else. And it's a good feeling, you know, and they want to have their say. You know, most of us do. The vast majority of us do, especially if we feel like we're misunderstood or, you know, a full story hasn't come out. So that's the most satisfying to me when, you know, the book is done or even during the book, people will tell me, you know, thank you so much for listening to me.
sounds
well,
great.
And that's really cool because we know just from other people, you know, that we've talked to, plus it stands to reason, that, you know, you're dealing with such delicate topics, and it would, I just thinking about it makes me kind of, how would you go about, you know, doing that? But for the people around the victims, you know, to say thank you for doing this, that's really cool.
It is.
Because they could be really mad.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, and you never know what kind of reaction you're going to get. But I have to say, it's extremely rare for me to have anyone turn me down. Because I'm, and I think part of the reason is because I'm very upfront with people. You know, I'm honest and I'm empathetic. And it's funny, when I first decided I was going to write the book about Kitty Genovese, I couldn't talk anyone else into doing it, so I had to do it myself. I actually read some books on writing true crime. And one thing that I read that stuck with me was, don't write true crime if you are uncomfortable in dealing with other people's pain. And once I, you know, now that I've written it, I mean, I understand that so fully. I mean, you only understand it kind of superficially until you've done it. But, you know, when I sit with people who knew, you know, who either were attacked themselves or were the, you know, unwitting loved one of someone who became a murderer, and just, you know, the emotion and everything that comes out, it makes me feel good to be able to let them talk to me.
It must be really strange. You know, it must be really strange to be have a relative become a murderer. What were your experiences dealing with people like that? Like, it must be traumatic.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't say I know, because I don't think any of us really know, even having spoken to so many people who are in that position. You never really know the toll, what it's like, and the toll that it really takes.
Yeah. Wow.
So I like that you said when you decided to write this book on Kitty Genovese, which I want to talk about that too in a minute, because, hey, that's cool. Nobody's really done that as far as I'm aware. It's a great story. It's a very important story. It's, I think, something that there's a lot of misinformation about. And we'll get into that. But what you said was, when you decided to write that book, you went out and you got some books on true crime and learned about it. So you sound, and I love this, you sound like you're just the kind of person who decides, I want to do this, and you just go learn how to do it, and you do it.
Is
that a fair assessment?
Yeah.
That's cool.
And in fact, what I did was I went and I got this secondhand book about, a couple secondhand books about how to write true crime. And they were kind of old and dated, but I mean, it was very good information. It was, you know, essentially about how to, you know, put things together and what are the elements and blah, blah, blah. But I also read scores and scores of true crime books. Now, I had always read them because I always found them interesting. But what I did is I made a point of reading, you know, some of the best in the genre, you know, the classics, Blood and Money and The Onion Field and books like that. And I read those multiple times to see how the authors would make transitions. But I also made a point of going to, like, the YMCA book fair and picking up the paperbacks and the true crime books that had never taken off, because I wanted to know why. I think it's as important to know why something doesn't work. And the answer, and across the board, I found out the answer. The books, the true crime books that did not work, that didn't, you know, resonate or go anywhere, is because the author ignored character. You didn't know anything about these people. And if you think about it, I mean, a crime is a crime. You know, if I tell you, well, someone was stabbed on the street, oh, that's a shame. But if I tell you, oh, she was 28 years old and, you know, she had these dreams, she wanted to own a restaurant, you know, and I introduce you to this person, that's what hooks you. I mean, that's what, not you.
Well,
everybody,
you know, this,
I mean, all of us.
Absolutely. And this is totally true. I think, with fiction and nonfiction alike, because that's mm-hmm. one of the main reasons I'll put down, I'll put a novel away, is because it's like, you know, this is really exciting and all this cool stuff's happening, but I don't know or connect with or care about anybody in the book. Movies
right.
are the same way. I mean, it's a psychological truth that, you know, if you want people to pay attention, you need to give them something to care about.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and that's where I think my background as a playwright came in handy, because in the theater, the focus is always on character, or should be.
Right.
And my playwriting mentor was the great Emanuel Fried. And when I was, I took his, the only playwriting class I ever took in my life when I was 19 years old. And he gave me the single best piece of writing advice I ever got, that I've ever heard. He said, "You never, ever write about events. You only write about people."
Yep.
And
I love that.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So true.
I love that. I'm going to take a quick station break. And when we get back, we want to talk about Kitty Genovese, of course. But first, very briefly, I just want to remind you that you're listening to Thorn and Cross, Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne, and we are here with true crime writer Catherine Pellinero. You can learn more about what we do at our websites, alistaircross.com and tamarathorne.com. You can visit our mutual blog at thornandcross.wordpress.com, or if you tweet, our handles are at tamarathorne and at crossalistair. You can also visit us on Facebook on our Haunted Nights Live page. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at authorsontheair.com. If you're listening online, please click the follow button. This is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. And again, we're here with Catherine Pellinero, New York Times bestselling author of Kitty Genovese and Absolute Madness. I do have one question for you before we get into Kitty Genovese. It's just more about your job and mm-hmm. what you do. I know that as horror authors, we get kind of a lot of ideas people have about us. You know, we must be really creepy and stuff, and that's fine. It doesn't bother me at all. But I'm curious about what people think. What are the misconceptions that you think people have about you when they find out that you write about true crime?
Wow, that's a great question. I guess it's hard to say, but I guess maybe that they think that. Well, one thing is they seem to think that I know about every high-profile murder that's ever happened. Because
right.
I will get messages. I have my Facebook page and I have my website, and I'll get messages about crimes that I never wrote about or anything. And I guess it was not too long after a Casey Anthony case, a woman wrote to me, and she said, says, "Oh, I love your shows, blah, blah, blah." She says, "Could you please just tell me one thing? Can you please just tell me, is Casey Anthony guilty or not? I just need to know." And I okay, I've never written anything about Casey Anthony. I've never spoken about her on a show, but and I've gotten things like that. You know, people will they seem to know things that I'm like in the know on all of these any high profile case. So it's kind of interesting.
Right, right. Well, you're an expert now. You wrote a book.
mm-hmm. Everything. Yes.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So. I am interested immensely in Kitty Genovese. This is a tale, is a case that happened a long time ago. And the first time I heard about it was many years ago, and I heard a very black and white version of what actually happened. And not too long ago, I saw something on Netflix, but it sounds like I watch a lot of Netflix. I think I do. But anyway, I saw something on Netflix that was a little more in-depth, and I thought some of that was really interesting. So I guess, first off, can you tell us who Kitty Genovese was as a person, you know, who she was, and what happened to her?
Sure, absolutely. Her full name was Catherine Genovese, and Kitty was her nickname. That's what she preferred to be called. And in 1964, she was 28 years old. She was working as a manager at a bar in Queens called Ev's 11th Hour. And Kitty's big ambition was that she wanted to own a restaurant and bar of her own someday. She wanted to own an Italian restaurant. She was very ambitious. She was also a very good businesswoman. By all accounts, had a great sense of business. Kitty Genovese had been married briefly after high school, and that marriage was annulled. She and her husband actually split up after only 2 months, which in 1954, that was a big deal, you know, especially both of them being Catholic. But Kitty was a lesbian, and at the time of her death, she was living with her partner, Marianne Zelenko, in a nice little apartment in Kew Gardens, Queens. Now, that's something that the police discovered right away as soon as they started investigating the murder, but for obvious reasons, that was not made public information, you know, at the time.
Right.
So, Kitty was, you know, she was someone who, as cliched as it sounds, had everything to live for. You know, life was going well. She had this nice apartment. She had this this great job that she was thinking was, you know, really take her somewhere. I think she did have hopes of either buying Ev's or, you know, possibly buying a place of her own. And she came home one night in March. She had gone out with a friend. And then she was, it was interesting. Kitty was supposed to, her friend dropped her off at Ev's, the place where she worked. She had planned to stay the night with friends of hers who lived right above the bar. You know, they had an apartment right above the bar. And sort of, and at the last minute, she says, you know, I think I'll go home. And this would have been about 3 o'clock in the morning. So it was just kind of on a whim. She decided she was going to go home instead of stay the night. And she gets in her car. And unfortunately, a man named Winston Mosley, who was out with the specific purpose of looking for a woman to kill, sees Kitty get into her car alone. Doesn't know her. He just sees a woman get into her car alone. And he follows her back to Kew Gardens. He parks his car, and he waits for her to get out of her car. Winston Mosley, by the way, is 29 years old. He is a married family man, has a great job. He's been there, been in his job for 10 years, owns his own home, a couple of cars, a couple of kids, you know. But his wife was a nurse who was working the night shift. And every once in a while, Mosley would get the urge to go out and find a woman to kill. And those are his words. That was his purpose. So he sees Kitty Genovese get out of her car, and she sees him, and unfortunately does not get back in her car. She tries to make it to her apartment. And when I was writing the story, I put myself in Kitty's place, you know, thinking, you know, in a way I understand it, you know, being in your 20s and thinking, I'm a little suspicious. I've got a weird feeling, but he's probably not, you know, paying attention to me. I'm overreacting.
Sure.
So she starts, I mean, I get that. You know, I think you learn as you get older, don't ignore that gut instinct. So she starts walking to her apartment, looks over her shoulder, and she sees him coming after her. So she starts screaming for help, and she starts running down Austin Street, which is a fairly busy street in Kew Gardens, but of course this is after 3 o'clock in the morning. Mosley catches up to her, and he stabs her twice in the back, and she lets out this horrific scream, oh my God, he stabbed me, somebody help me, please help me. This was right across the street from a 10-story apartment building called the Mowbray, and there were people who had awakened when they heard her first screams. When they heard that scream, even more people awakened. And, you know, as some neighbors described it, you know, there were just lights going on all over the place. And some of them, you know, open their windows and they look out. And one of them yells down, leave that girl alone. So Mosley looks up. He sees he's being watched by all these neighbors. And he runs. He turns and he runs away. So Kitty gets to her feet. She's been stabbed twice in the back. And there's probably some shock that's set in. And she turns around and she's trying to get to the entrance to her apartment, which is in the back of the building. So, in other words, she has to go and turn two corners. You know, normally we're talking about a one-minute walk, but she's injured and she starts hanging onto the building. She's kind of crying and moaning. At one point, we know from the witness statements, you know, she's at least a couple witnesses heard her say, if somebody doesn't help me, I'm going to die. Well, she makes it to the back of the building and she goes to the first unlocked door. She can't make it all the way down to her apartment. But she makes it to this door, which opens into a little vestibule, and there are stairs right above. She knows the man who lives in the apartment at the top of the stairs. His name is Carl Ross. He's a friend of hers. So she collapses in the hallway, and she starts calling to him, Carl, help me, I've been stabbed. And we know that because there was a woman who lived in an apartment two doors down. This is only a two-story building. And in her police, in her statement to the police, she explains that Carl Ross, instead of going down to help Kitty or calling the police, goes over to her apartment, bangs on the window and says, Kitty's in the hallway calling help. I don't want to get involved. I don't know what to do. And they stand there having this conversation about what should they do, because this neighbor doesn't have her own phone. And in the meantime, Kitty's calling. She's calling, somebody, help me, help me. Now, Mosley, what he did when he ran away was he went back to his car, and he backed it onto a side street. And he waits a few minutes. He estimated he waited about 10 minutes. And there were no sirens, and none of the neighbors came outside. So he decides he's going to go and look for her. So he gets out, and because so many people watched him come back to look for Kitty, we can pretty much retrace his steps everywhere. Well, finally, he walks around to the back. He tries that door, and he sees Kitty lying in the hallway. And she screams so loud that people around the block hear her last screams for help. But he pounces on her, he stabs her in the throat, and then he proceeds to stab her more in the chest, sexually assaults her, and stabs her enough times that it'll eventually cause her death. So the police are called, finally, after Mosley flees. And now, in the meantime, her friend, Carol Ross, has just kept calling neighbors. Can somebody go down and see what's wrong with Kitty? So he finally gets a hold of this other woman who lives in the building, who actually lives across the street or across the hallway from Kitty, named Sophie Farrar. Mm-hmm. So Sophie throws on her robe, and she runs down there, you know, to see if Kitty's okay. And sees Kitty on the floor, and she's stabbed, and there's blood, and she, you know, yells at Carl Ross to call the police. And Sophie holds Kitty until the ambulance gets there. Carl Ross makes the call at 3:50 a.m., and at 3:52, the first police car gets there. So the police responded right away when they finally were called. Now, there's been a lot of controversy in the last 2 years about, oh, well, people didn't really know what was going on. And I have to tell you, I came to this very fresh. This was before my time. I mean, I really had no preconceived notions. I was completely open to, hey, maybe this was a complete exaggeration. And while there were some flaws in the original reporting, it was essentially correct. There were enough people who had very good cause to know that something very bad was happening. If they didn't know it was a murder, that, you know, this woman's screaming, she's calling for help, and things could have been different if even one of those people who was hanging their head out the window had said, are you okay? Do you need help? Should I call the police? And no one did.
Right. That's remarkable. Amazing. That's basically the original story that I heard, and I've later seen things that, like you said, claim, well, that's exaggeration. That's not really how it happened. They tried to, you know, I saw one where they tried to kind of blame it on the police department, and, well, all these people called, and the police just didn't respond, and then they blamed it on the citizens. So, that's crazy. Isn't she the reason that they have 911 now?
Yes, that was partly inspired, I would say actually largely inspired, by Kitty's murder. Because, you know, once the story went viral 1960s style, it literally went around the world, and people talked about it for months and months, and, you know, it's still taught in psychology courses. One of the things that the neighbors said, that some of the neighbors said, well, it's time to call the police. I didn't know what number to call. Because at that time, you know, you could call your local precinct, but it should also be kept in mind. You could also just dial 0 for an operator. So, and I think what the best I've heard, the way with the revisionist history, is people say, well, the New York Times made it sound like 38 people watched for a half an hour. And I said, well, okay, well, you know, that's a little bit splitting hairs because, I mean, the Times had photographs and they showed that Kitty went around the building, you know, she went around two corners.
Yeah.
Yes, if you, for anyone who thinks that 38 people sat for 30 minutes straight and watched a murder, then no, that's not the story. But what happened was even more than 38 people heard a woman screaming for help, maybe peeked out and saw her staggering down the street and did nothing. And,
wow.
You know, as one detective said, how much do you need to see and hear before you act? So
right.
I guess
yeah.
that was sort of the out, that they didn't see the whole thing from start to finish. But I don't buy that as an excuse, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So yeah. So, what kind of people did you meet in that were involved in this in your research with this case?
Okay. Well, because so much time had passed, there were obviously a lot of people who had passed away. But I was fortunate to speak with two of the original investigating detectives, and people who lived in the neighborhood who were kids at the time that this happened. Pretty much all of the parents had passed away for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, but there were kids, you know, they were kids at the time, you know, who remembered it well and, you know, what had happened and what was, you know, what the neighborhood was like. And then I made a point of speaking to as many people who knew Kitty Genovese as I possibly could. You know, I did speak to Marianne, her lover. I spoke to high school friends of hers, people who had worked with her. In fact, the coworker who was the very last person to speak to her that night before she was murdered. So, you know, because I wanted to obviously present her as the real full
right.
person that she was, you know, rather than,
yeah.
you know, the stick figure. So.
Right. Now, in your experience and all the things that you've researched and learned, do you think that this particular case was a matter of place, as in, well, that's just New York, or times, like, well, that was just the 60s? Or do you uh-huh. think that kind of apathy is rampant?
Oh, I
even
do.
Today?
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with time or place. And I'm not sure that apathy is the right word, because apathy, at least to me, sort of implies indifference. You
yeah.
know, can't be bothered. And I would say that the big motivation with in Kitty's case and in so many others that have happened since was fear. It was fear and self-preservation.
Fear, yeah, I don't know what to do. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And to a certain extent, that's understandable. This is 3 o'clock in the morning on a winter night. I would be terrified if I was awakened by screams at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So, I mean, I understand that. But, you know, it's very interesting. Someone had commented to me shortly after the book came out that if it happened today, we would have 38 cell phone videos. And I think, sadly, that might be the truth. I mean, because we hear cases about that. You know, crimes in
right.
progress
yeah.
or rape or an attack. And instead of helping, people are filming it on their phone and then they put it online. And, I mean, that's, you know, I don't know how
right.
you can do
right.
something like that. But we know it happens.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a tricky thing because I think we've all been in situations before that are and I think I'm glad that you said that about fear, because I think that is right. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
I think we've all been
yeah.
in situations where we've come across some sort of shocking, I don't know, there is almost like a knee
sure.
jerk, I don't want to get involved type of, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what to do. I don't know how I
for
could
sure.
help this situation, you know, yeah.
Right. And I think there's also a lot to the bystander theory that LaTanya and Darley came up with, you know, in their research in the wake of this case, where they said that the more people who witness an incident, the less likely any of them are to help, because we take our cues from each other. You know, so Kitty might have had
right.
a better chance of getting help if it had just been like one person on the street.
Right.
They did a lot of experiments like that, you know, where they would put some usually college students, like in a room or something, and the smoke would start coming under the door. And, you know, the one who was not part of the experiment would be looking around and, you know, try to take his cues from the others. And if they didn't react, you know, 9 times out of 10, the other one didn't either. And I think
wow.
we could see that in play in Kitty's case, because, you know, in newspaper interviews, the neighbors were saying, well, yeah, there was windows open all down the block. So these people are watching each other not do anything and figure, okay, so we don't do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you actually
right.
say that to yourself, but yeah.
Wow. That's what it boils down to. Yeah. True.
Yeah. So what would you say originally got you interested in this case?
Well, it was funny. Years and years ago, I had this day job that I absolutely hated at a financial firm. And I was, you know,
I'll bet. No, say no more. No.
Yeah. So I was kind of goofing off and just playing on the internet. And somehow I came across this website about Kitty, the Kitty Genovese case. And this is something I had heard about before. And really my only association with it was when I was a kid, there was a TV movie that came out called Death Scream, which was sort of a fictionalized version of it. But I didn't know really much about the case. But so anyway, I find this website, and it was really a website about Kew Gardens, Queens, where this crime had happened. But there was a big, long section on Kitty Genovese, and it was, in fact, questioning the original New York Times story. And I found it very, very interesting. And I kept going back to the website, and I ended up writing to the webmaster, a gentleman named Joseph DeMay. And we started talking about the case back and forth via email. And actually, Joe is, he and I have remained friends. We ended up becoming best friends. But anyway, this was sort of my first real introduction to the case. And I thought, once I first found the website, I thought, well, this is a high-profile case. I really want to read, I want to know more. I want to read a book about it. And I went on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or something, figuring it's so famous, there's got to be 3 or 4 books. And there weren't any. So long story short, I ended up writing the book I wanted to read. And that's how I pitched it to editors.
Right. That's a good one, though, because that's good advice across the board. That's what we do, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought, well, hey, if I want to know, because I want to know, who was Kitty Genovese and who was Winston Mosley, this family man who became a murderer and killed her? And, you know, and then I had extensive interviews with Mosley, you know, over a few years.
And what about him? What he obviously got caught. How did that happen? How many people did he hurt? And you said you've talked to him?
Oh, we did. Yes. We corresponded for many, many years. In fact, about 4 years in all. Yeah, Mosley died in 2016, but that was actually key, and that was something that was tough for me when I started, you know, writing true crime, that I would sort of have to forge a relationship with this, you know, with this killer. As far as how many people he hurt, I believe he killed 3. As far how many he hurt, very hard to say because he was a rapist first. So
yeah.
And he estimated that he had probably committed about, I think he said 50 or 60 burglaries and maybe 20 to 30 rapes. So, exclusive of the murders, you know, different from the murders. So, you know, very.
So, how do you
know,
go about when you decide to do this and it comes to the time where you need to talk to this criminal, this killer? How do you? How do you go about that? Do you just say, hey, you know, I'm interested in, I don't even know how to phrase it. How do you go about that?
Well, what I did was I wrote Winston Mosley a letter, and I introduced myself, and I was very professional, you know, dear Mr. Mosley, and I told him who I was, and, you know, I'm writing a book about this, and I would like to talk to you and, you know, maybe talk to your family members, and, you know, with a polite and professional letter, you know, then he wrote back to me, but he was not thrilled with the idea of a book and said, you know, I don't think I'm really interested. So I wrote back to him and I said, well, you know, thank you so much for your reply. You know, if there's anything you want to talk about, anything else you want to talk about, feel free to keep writing to me. And he did. Now with Joseph Christopher passed away in 1993. So speaking to him was not an option. But for me was just the key with my interviews is I just approach them. I'm always respectful and polite, but I'm a real person. You know, I never it's funny because mostly, you know, we had such a rapport after a while that he would send me letters that he would get from different, you know, reporters, writers, or whomever were wanting an interview. And I knew immediately why he wasn't getting, you know, why these people were getting no response from him, because they were, for the most part, condescending. You know, the attitude was, hey, I'll do you a favor by giving you a voice in this interview. And that's absolutely the wrong way to approach anyone, but especially a sociopath. I mean,
Right. Oh, let me do you a favor. It makes sense. When you were talking to him, did you ever I don't think you can do this, but you'd never met him face to face, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, I didn't think so, because I think that these people are in prisons that you can't really do that. I don't know how all this works, but did you ever your impression of him, aside from the crimes that he committed, you said the word sociopath. Do you think you would have known that had you not known who? I guess what I'm trying to ask is this someone that you would have seen coming?
Oh, no. No, and in fact, just to briefly explain, a sociopath is, in essence, someone who has no empathy for others. No empathy, no sense of remorse, nothing like that. Mm-hmm. They just don't connect with others. And in fact, the very best description I ever heard of a sociopath was from a book called The Mask of Sanity by Herbie Cleckley. And I'm paraphrasing a bit, but he said a sociopath is only after a long period of time, a period of time after you've gotten to know this person, that you realize this is not a full human being at all, but a subtly constructed reflex machine capable of mimicking the human personality perfectly.
Ooh.
And that is a perfect
great.
Description.
Yeah.
Not a full human being.
Yeah. Now, I've read various opinions on this, and maybe it's something that you know, or maybe something you have an opinion on. How many sociopaths in the world? I know that they're not all violent. They're not all necessarily violent killers. Some of mm-hmm. them are just, normal workaday people. They just don't have a conscience. But I've read, I think one that I read was about one in every 100 people are sociopathic. I've read other things, too. Do you have any opinion on that?
I don't, and I would think that number is kind of I don't think that it's that common. I mean, my guess would be more like one in 5,000 or something. But I should say I have no medical background. But I just don't think a genuine sociopath is that common. And you're absolutely right about not all of them are violent, because Winston Mosley's mother, in my opinion, from what I learned about her, was a sociopath. She didn't kill anyone, but this is a woman who was chronically unfaithful to her husband, and kind of flaunted it in front of him. And what was so strange about it was that she couldn't even conceive of why he was upset about this.
Of course.
Out,
it's like, why? I had
fun. When he was a little boy. Exactly. And, so these are people who don't get it. I mean, they just don't understand. Yeah. They have no capacity to feel for other people.
Right. So now, we're running out of time, but I do have a couple more questions. Do you see yourself ever going back to playwriting or comedy?
Well, never say never. I would like to write another play, but I have to tell you, I really enjoy the true crime genre. I mean, it's not something I ever had planned on, but it's just something I really enjoy. And with the books that I write, I like to think that I'm putting something positive out of there, something that was obviously horribly negative, by maybe getting a little bit more perspective, giving a more in-depth account. So I would think I will stick with true crime, but you never know.
All right. And you've done Kitty Genovese and Absolute Madness, both very big sellers, both very, well received. What's in the works? What are you planning on in the future? Or are you working on something right now?
Well, actually, I'm tossing around an idea for my next true crime book, and also, more true crime television. Very interested in doing something with Absolute Madness, as far as a series on that, like a mini series on that. So, kind of the field is wide open. I will certainly write another book, and I'm hoping actually in the next couple of months you know, to be able to make an announcement about that. So, but and
cool.
It's definitely
I'll keep
in the
my
true
eye
crime
out.
Genre.
All right.
Oh, you won't have
and,
to. Well, I will let you know.
Okay, do, because we would love to have you back, absolutely, for real. So when you have something new, let us know, and we'll do this again. I did want to know, though, I've seen you on more than one thing. Murderous Affairs was the one that I remembered, but I think I saw you, like, three or four different things, because I'm a true crime junkie.
Okay.
I go on these binges, and I watch this stuff. Anyway,
yeah.
do you ever get nervous? You seem very natural on the camera, which is fantastic. But I think it would be absolutely nerve-wracking. Is it?
No, not for me. And maybe because I never aspired to be an actress or something. So it doesn't really matter to me how I look on camera, because it's not like I'm hoping to get the next job or anything. So as long as you sit me down and talk to me about something that I find interesting, that's fine. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Start talking, like asking me math questions or something, then I'm going to get panicky. But
yeah,
you know?
right. Hey, I'll pay you $5 if you do your next one, like in sweats and in a stained T-shirt and have your hair all messy. $5.
$5? A whole $5.
Whenever the $5 comes up,
dumb.
Ignore him. Yeah. He's never up to good.
Any
good
for
anything.
It.
No.
But I know, Tamara, you've been on some shows too. Is it ever nerve wracking for you?
Not really, no, because I'm talking about what I know. It's like what Catherine said. It's kind of fun, and you catch on real fast, and it really is kind of fun. Yeah.
All right. Well. All right, well, we're just about out of time. I had a good time. I kind of probably monopolized the whole thing, but I was interested in stuff. So
we knew you were going to. It wasn't a problem.
I told you. I told you I would.
I know, and I let you.
So thanks for just being so
you'll
patient
pay for it
and
tomorrow.
Listening.
Yes, congratulations.
Okay.
Congratulations to
Catherine,
both of you
been,
on the new
been
book.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank
you.
Charming
as I thought you were going to be, and I'm serious when I say we'd love to have you back, and
I'll
keep my eyes open for your upcoming events, and maybe next time I'll let Tamara talk a little bit more. Maybe.
I
don't know.
Thank you so much for having me on. I was so looking forward to this.
Oh,
you're welcome.
We really
very briefly,
enjoyed it.
Before we let you go, can you tell the listeners where they can find out more about you and what you do?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you can Google me. That's an easy one. And also, my website is CatherineCalamaro.net. You probably want to give me a few days, though, because that darn thing has not been updated in a couple of months. But it's CatherineCalamaro.net, and I also have an author page on Facebook. Three of them. There's actually my author page and then a page for Kitty Genovese and a page for Absolute Badness, the book.
Oh, great.
All right. All right, thank you for being here, and thank you, everybody, for listening. And until next week, we wish you haunted nights.
And sweet screams.
Thank you for listening.
Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.